This is Margaret Weiss.
And I'm Tracy Hickman. We're the authors of Dragonlance and the new Dragonship series.
And you are listening to the Season 3 premiere of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
Bringing you authors of science fiction and fantasy, publishing industry analysis, writing tips, book reviews, and the occasional belly laugh.
World while you were gone.
Nice segue there, Sean.
It's Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
This is Hugo and Nebula Award-winning author Robert J. Sawyer.
And now, streaming from the Singularity Audio Studios in San Diego, California, your hosts. And welcome to the Season 3 premiere of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. My name's Sean Farrell.
And I'm Sam Wins.
Aren't you excited, Sam?
I am. Season 3.
Yeah.
You're like the Love Boat. Not shiny and new.
Not too much pop and circumstance this time, but that's okay. You know, we'll just go with it.
Yeah.
Remember last year we had a big old build up in this massive episode to... That's all right.
You guys don't expect that much from us, do you?
No.
We're lazy.
They know better than that.
Yeah. Also, I'd like to say I'm exciting and new, as well as shiny and new.
Exciting, shiny,
I totally realized I just
new.
Misquoted the Love Boat, and then I was ashamed, so I had to...
That's okay. I didn't catch it.
I had to fix
so.
It. I know. But someone out there will, and they'll be like, Sam, you fool!
Yeah, there's some nerd out there that probably would have caught that.
Yeah. I know it.
Well, as you heard from the pre-intro, our guests today are Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman, the best-selling fantasy duo of all time. So, had a great time talking with them. It was a lot of fun. And we're going to talk about their new fantasy series, the importance of literature, and the first science fiction film to be shot completely in space, which was written by Tracy.
So that is completely awesome.
That was awesome. I didn't know about this. And it's at the end of the interview, and I think you'll enjoy it. But first, let's start off the year with some news.
From the website of Robert J. Sawyer, Flash Forward, which tells the story of an experiment gone awry that throws the collective human consciousness 20 years into the future,
dun, 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 dun.
Is being adapted to television by David S. Goyer and Brandon Braga. Goyer is a golden child in Hollywood right now.
That's my opinion, by the way. That comes from me.
Yeah, I know. But I agree with you, so I said it with flair.
Right on.
He's a golden child in Hollywood right now, having penned Batman Begins, which, you know, as we all know, was completely awesome, and all three Blade movies. Braga is most famous for his years producing and writing in the Star Trek franchise. Now, this part particularly excites me. He won a Hugo Award for his script, All Good Things, the final episode in Star Trek The Next Generation, which was co-written with Ronald D. Moore. And he wrote one of the best Star Trek films of all time. Again, Sean's opinion, but mine too. First Contact. Can I just say, I'm sorry, I'm interjecting in the news, but All Good Things was one of the best television episodes, I think, ever written. It was such a great ending to a series. Sean and I were talking about this before we actually started taping today, and how they went out on top, and they went out with one of their best seasons, with one of their best episodes of the season.
Yeah.
And it was fulfilling, yet bittersweet. It was awesome.
It had a great plot.
Yeah.
With great science fictional twists. And I think what really was the icing on the cake that really made it fulfilling, though, was the emotional resonance in that episode.
Absolutely.
And you don't often get all of those things together at the same time. I think it's pretty rare. And really, even in Star Trek The Next Generation, which was really solid for the last four seasons especially, and they were really strong in the emotional part of it and the character-driven part of it. So you didn't often get the story element because they're, you know, you think of episodes like Tin Man, you know, where most of it's just kind of on the ship and then with this weird alien thing. You know, it's not that very exciting story-wise. And so I think that's why it stood out.
I agree. And when it's panning away and it's Captain Picard's face and you pan away from him and, you know, at the end, I cried. I'm not ashamed to admit it. Okay. Back to the news, though. Sawyer says Goyer and Braga are creatively brilliant, and their work on Flash Forward is very exciting. And I quote, "It's often said that one has to cut out and water down when turning a 350-page novel into a two-hour movie." That's a quote from Sawyer. That may be so, but these guys are taking a 350-page novel as the jumping-off point for a 100-hour TV series that requires an expansion of vision. End quote. Sawyer goes on to praise the new directions of the TV series, comparing it to CBS's hit show Lost, which also I'm a huge fan of, so that resonates with me. If you think you got it all figured out, Sawyer said, trust me, you don't. Filming for Fast Forward will begin on February 11th.
Robert J. Sawyer is living my dream right now. You know?
I know. <He's> like, absolutely.
With his books and the adaptations, and he's hosting a TV show that's debuting, I think, next month in Canada.
Oh, man.
It's like, man, he's like living my life.
Yeah. And
he stole it from me.
And Robert, hey, Robert, you know, if you need anyone to like cast for this show, I'm just saying, you know where to reach us. That's all.
Oh, yeah. We're brilliant.
Yeah. If you need a really, really tall blonde person, I'm your woman.
What I find interesting about this, though, and what I want to mention real quick here, is how many books were seen brought to the screen. I mean, just think about in the last couple of years, there's Legend of the Seeker, which is on right now.
Yeah.
And I've watched a little bit of it. We have A Song of Ice and Fire coming out on HBO. The Charlene Harris series, I can't remember what it's called, but...
The Sookie Stackhouse novels.
And that's...
True Blood is this... No, HBO.
It's HBO also. That's
True Blood is the name of the series on HBO.
Okay. Okay, that's what I thought. I thought it was called True Blood.
And it's great!
I haven't seen it. But then there's The Dresden Files. That was on Sci-Fi.
Mm-hmm.
Movie adaptations, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter. I'll think of all the Philip K. Dick books that have been made into films over the last few years. And it really seems that Hollywood is turning to science fiction literature for their stories. And I mean, I know there's always been adaptations of books, but it just seems like there's more and more of it. And even in things like Stargate Universe, just hired John Scalzi to be a consultant to give them story ideas. And you have Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles, where they're referring to terms like the technological singularity in the show.
Yeah.
And you never see that in sci-fi TV.
Right.
You know? And they did it correctly. They really knew it. So these writers know science fiction literature, not just what other films have done. And to me, it's very exciting.
It's incredibly exciting. You have the purists who are like, oh, you cannot make my favorite book into a movie. But I actually embrace that. I like seeing what other people's vision is going to be of that beloved work. You know, that's something that I love so much. And I love seeing it on the big screen when it's done well. Of course, when it's not done well, everyone's disappointed. But you got to take the risk. And I agree with you. There's so much good stuff out there being pulled. I mean, and from graphic novels, too.
Mm-hmm.
Look at all this stuff being made from comics. Watchmen is about to come out. It won a Hugo Award, for heaven's sake. Yeah, I'm with you. I'm super jazzed, actually, what's happening right now in the movie industry and on television. For a long time, I didn't watch any TV at all. And now, you know, my TiVo's having a hard time keeping up.
And it seems like there's most of it's on television, it seems. You know, the cable, with the success of The Sopranos, I think that really kicked it off. You could see that you could do a television show without the constraints of network television.
HBO does such good programming, I have to say.
Do.
So when they picked up George's Song of Ice and Fire, I was ecstatic.
Yeah, they can do it right. You know?
Yeah, if anyone's going to do it right, it's going to be them, I feel. And I have to say, I'm a big fan of True Blood. I've read Charlene's books. And, you know, while they do diverge, you know, from the plot a bit, I think the vision that they've taken is really true to the story, to Charlene's vision.
Yeah,
it's really stuck with it. And it's quite enjoyable. Anna Paquin just won... Best actress she just won a Golden Globe.
Oh, very
for that
cool.
show, actually.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, and it is harder to make a great film based on these books because you have to have a great script, the director with the right vision, great actors,
right cast.
The whole crew's got to be working together right. So there's a lot of different people who all have to be on the same page to make a great TV show. And Paul Levinson says we're living in a golden age of TV right now. And looking at the list we're discussing, he's probably right.
I agree. I mean, there's a lot of crappy reality shows out there.
Oh, yeah.
But,
besides those.
But there's also a lot of really good stuff. There's a lot of options for people right now.
Yeah.
I have one quick question for you, Sean.
Okay.
Do we know what station that Robert J. Sawyer's Flash Forward is going to be on? Do we have?
It's one of the big ones. I want to say it's CBS.
Okay. Cool.
But I don't know for sure. But it's one of the big three, if I remember correctly.
Good.
Yeah. But, you know, I'll post a link to this story on the website, and it may be in there. So come to the show notes and check it out through there. But for now, let's go ahead and take a break. And we have some cool new promos to share for the next 6 episodes or so. And then we'll be back with Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman, 2 of Sam's favorites.
When I think of fan fiction, I usually think, well, let's just say that quality is not the first thing I think of.
Codename Starkeeper blew me away.
Starkeeper brings back the magic of Star Wars.
The great story from somebody with more knowledge, love, and respect for the original trilogy than George Lucas himself.
The wide-eyed wonder that I felt when I first saw it as a very young child.
The characters are colorful and engaging.
The quality of the writing, production, and the acting are all top-notch.
The soaring excitement of when the Millennium Falcon first took off.
The action is gripping and the humor is spot-on.
I only have one problem. You're only producing 8 episodes.
This isn't just a worthy fan production. It's the best new Star Wars story to come along in years.
Codename Starkeeper is my favorite full cast fan fiction podcast.
Bravo to Indiana Jim and his entire cast. The Force is definitely strong with them.
Star Wars, codename Starkeeper. Winner of 6 Star Wars Fanworks Fan Audio Awards, including Best Audio Drama, Best Director Jim Perry, and Best Mixer Joe Harrison. Available now in all 8 episodes.
100% podcaster babble free.
At www.indianajim.net and StarWarsFanWorks.com.
Joining us today are both halves of the best-selling fantasy writing duo of all time, the creators of Dragonlance, Dark Sword, and the Death Gate Cycle, Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman, whose new series, Dragon Ships of the Vendress, has recently debuted with Book 1, Bones of the Dragon. Margaret and Tracy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having us.
It's great to be back.
This is the first time I've recorded 2 authors at the same time, so it's exciting for me. You guys are my guinea pigs.
This is like stereo, isn't it, Sean?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I always like to start at the beginning. So I want to ask, how did you two first meet, and when did you decide to take a crack at a novel together?
Well, that could take up about the whole 30 minutes. We met at TSR Incorporated, the people who did Dungeons & Dragons, and Tracy was a game designer in charge of the Dragonlance project. And I was the editor hired to edit the Dragonlance project, the novel.
Yeah, and that's how we met. We met at TSR back in the old days when there was a TSR. And we're very excited about the TSR pension plan, I think, was one of the big hiring points at the time.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But after we had met there, as happens so often, of course, the people that you know are not the people that you think are the most qualified for any job. And so the company had wanted to do novels as part of this Dragonlance series. In fact, it hired Margaret on, I think, to be the editor of Dragonlance. Soon became obvious to us that we were the ones who understood the story. It was the story that Margaret and I were developing together with, along with Michael Williams at that time. And it was very much our story. But the company had hired an author from the outside in order to do this project. And as the pages started coming in, it was obvious to us that this outside writer just did not understand the story and the characters and the world in the same way that we did. And so on one weekend, we've gotten together, and on one weekend, Margaret wrote the prologue and the first 5 chapters of what was to become Dragons of Autumn Twilight.
And I've never done that since. I have never since written 5 chapters in a prologue in 2 days.
Oh, wow.
But we were so incredibly caught up in the story. It really seemed to tell itself.
And so impassioned about it being done right, of course. And that fueled Margaret's fire, I'm sure, that weekend. So that Monday, we came back into the office and presented the papers to Jean Blashfield Black, who was senior editor at the time. And she went into her office, and I think we went into Margaret's office and just kind of bit our nails there waiting for her to finish. And when she came out, much to her credit, she said, yes, this is exactly what we need. This is exactly what it has to be. And so they paid off the author that they had hired to do these books originally. And
this is why we didn't get in advance.
That's right. They gave all the money to him, and but they made up for it by giving us a very small royalty.
And they kept all the rights.
And they kept all the rights. Yeah. Oh, what a great deal we made.
Oh, but it was a great deal.
It did work out in the end rather well, I would say.
It's been very, very good to us, and it's led to this incredible partnership and friendship that's lasted now in the 25 years.
25 years.
Margaret, as you said, you were the editor at the time, but according to my research, you did have a BA in creative writing, so I assume it's safe for me to think that writing was something very close to your heart and something you wanted to do.
Yes, and in fact, I had several books published by the Juvenile Nonfiction. A book on Frank and Jesse James was one. And in fact, that is why they had hired me as editor, because they were doing the Endless Quest, not Endless Quest, yeah, the Endless Quest books. And and those required a lot of rewriting as well as editing, because we were putting them out at such a rapid pace that when the author turned them in, we really didn't have time to go back to the author and say, here, rewrite this. We just did it. And so one reason they had hired me was because I was a writer.
Yeah, I remember those Endless Quest books. I think I was like 4 years old or something. No, I'm just kidding. I couldn't help but throw something like that.
Yes, we're not feeling old at all. No.
Well, knowing what you know now about collaboration after having done so many books together, what piece of advice, if you could go back in time and give yourselves a piece of advice about the process, what would it be?
Well, I think that we respect each other, and we respect each other's opinions and ideas, even when we may disagree, and which is generally rarely. So that's what I would say.
Yeah, and I think along with that respect goes along a tremendous respect for the integrity of the story itself. That even when you disagree, the important thing is the story and not the egos that are involved, not the personal opinions or differences of opinion that are involved, but that the story have the integrity that it needs. And Margaret and I have tremendous respect for one another. We've been through so much together down through the years. And we're very different people. We have very different opinions. And we see the world through different eyes, but I think in many ways that's a great strength for us. It gives us the ability to have some perspective on what we write and to inject into it some perspectives that we might otherwise normally not advocate or put in the text. One of the things that I worry about very often in our day and age is that so many people reduce the level of their discomfort with new information. It's very easy to avoid things that you don't agree with today. All you have to do is switch to the right channel or the correct website, and suddenly you're validated in everything you think or have thought and are never challenged. It's the differences, actually, between Margaret and I that I think very much enhance the text, because we very oftentimes will challenge each other in our perspectives. And that, I think, for both of us is seen as a plus.
Very cool. Novel collaboration has always been something that fascinated me, and I've been able to talk with Larry Niven and Kevin J. Anderson about their collaborations, and both of them have been very successful at it in their careers. So that's always something I want to ask about, because it seems like it would be a tremendous challenge to write not just one, but what, for you guys, 30 novels together? It's pretty amazing.
But oh my goodness, that's an awful lot of novels. How many novels have we written? Now I have to count.
Speaking of your novels, we should go ahead and talk about the new one here. I wanted to start off by discussing something you each have a little bit of experience doing, and that's world building. Can you walk us through the process you use to create this vast and complex world that is the Dragon Ships of the Vendress?
That was mostly Tracy.
Oh, yes. Well, let's see. Well, first you start with the heaven and the earth. Oh, that's been pretty well documented,
yeah.
In our case, we actually did very much start with the heavens because the cosmology is at the root of everything that happens, especially when you're dealing with a fantasy series where the gods are so prominent and so involved in things that are going on in the realm of mortals,
yeah.
and our mortal heroes. And so in our case, we started with the basic cosmology of this universe, which wasn't working. The cosmology in this universe, the gods that are in this creation, in this world, have kind of slacked off and are failing. And so what happens in the great story here that's going on is that itinerant gods, as we call them, gods who have failed previously in their own creations or who are now wandering the creations in search of a new home, find this world is weak and the gods here are weak. And so they all move in trying to take over somebody else's creation and succeed by getting a second bite at the apple, so to speak. And so in this particular world, not only do we have to create a pantheon of gods for our mortals to begin with, but we had to create other pantheons of other gods and their own perspectives and ideas who were going to move into this world and vie ideologically and otherwise for supremacy in this world. So we started with that basic idea. And we also started with the basic idea that we wanted to do a fantasy version of an odyssey.
I was going to say this. It reminded me of Homer. And then here, there you go. All right. See, I'm onto something there.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. because we want to do that primarily because transportation technologies in medieval fantasy worlds are so limited, unless you leap immediately to magic, which we don't often like to do. And so we wanted to do a sea voyage. We wanted to do an odyssey. And we were very enamored with the idea of the Norsemen and the incredible far range that their ships had and that their travels had. They ranged all over the Germanic nations. Their voyages extended not only to the New World, but well into the Mediterranean. I mean, they went many places. And so all of these were very evocative images for us and shaped us in our world building as we created a world that was amazingly large and significantly complex, especially for a fantasy world. It's probably one of the more complex worlds we've ever attempted to do.
And the interesting thing about it is that most of the world, even after we've done our six books, is going to be relatively unknown because this was in an age where people couldn't fly across continents. And so we'll mainly see what we can reach by sea and a small ways inland.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're hoping actually to be able to eventually turn a lot of this world over to the fans to explore, to let them push back the horizons.
Yeah, we've got some really cool ideas along those lines.
Oh, you mean opening it up to fan fiction, that sort of thing?
Fan fiction?
Maybe fan fiction, although publishers kind of, get shivers at that.
Right.
But even to the point where fans would maybe take a clan of ogres or a tribe of ogres and invent stories about them and tell us who their chiefs are and everything else. And then perhaps we might use it in game product or mention it in a book. Just, kind of really involve the fans and make it a truly shared world, not shared just between authors, but with everybody.
Oh, that's awesome. Very cool. Well, you know, one of the things I really liked about Bones of the Dragon was that you gave some explanations for some of fantasy's longstanding traditions. And the example I'm thinking of here is the rationale for why dragons hoard treasure. And I really like that, the reason why they have to see the treasure before any of the human characters can have it. And I won't give it away in the podcast because people just need to read the book. but I'm wondering, how do you balance sticking to genre traditions and then bending tradition and then breaking tradition completely, maybe at the risk of alienating some of your audience? How do you balance that as you're putting this novel together?
I don't know. I don't think I'm really conscious of it. The idea about jewels and why dragons have always lusted after jewels, you know, had always fascinated me, but there didn't seem to be much motive behind it. I mean, right. Do you want just to have a bed of sharp things that poke you in the night? And, you know, but
that just sounds like
Tracy,
a bad camping trip to me.
Tracy then was the one that came up with the realization about why dragons want jewels, and it makes perfect sense once you understand it and read about it.
That's one of the wonderful parts about world building, actually, is sometimes answering just those simple kinds of questions can lead you into really deeper understandings and exciting new directions in your story. Once you understand the fundamentals and the motivations for characters or for things within the world, it can provide your characters with excellent motivation as well and a much better structural background for their actions.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that detail, and it ends up being a huge part of the story. And thank you, Tracy, for explaining the hoarding of treasure, because I'm with Margaret on that one. I never quite understood that. I know. This is a 6-book series published by Tor. What is the publishing schedule, and where are you two in the writing process?
We're working on the second book right now, and I don't think a decision's been made on when they're going to publish it. If you've read the book, you read at the back that our editor, Brian Thompson, died unexpectedly and very tragically. Mm-hmm. And that kind of threw everything, including us, into a tailspin. So we're just kind of working to get back into writing with our new editor, Eric Robb.
But we are working on the book now, and we're hoping to turn that second book in later on this year. And in the meantime, of course, working on a number of other projects as well.
Dragons of Hourglass Mage is finally coming out.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I wanted to ask you guys about that. You know, Tracy, we talked about this last time you were on the show in March of 2008, and we talked a great deal about what was happening with the final Dragonlance book. And at that time, you weren't in communication with the Wizards. But since then, you know that you guys are all settled and the book is coming along. Can you enlighten us as to what happened and how it was resolved and when the book will be coming out?
The book will be coming out in August, and I don't think we can talk about happened, can we?
I think we might paraphrase Shakespeare a little bit from Julius Caesar, and turn it a little bit on its head. Maybe Mark Anthony should have said, the good that men do should live after them, and the evil that they do ought to be interred with their bones. Perhaps so should it be with Dragons of an Hourglass Mage. The most important thing, I think, at this point, whatever happened back then, and to be absolutely truthful, we really don't know what happened.
No, that's true. We don't,
and we may never know, and perhaps that's just as well. The important thing is that we've been able to finish the book, and the book is being published. The book is now at Wizards of the Coast, and they're preparing it for press, so and they paid us and everything. So I think the important thing here is that the book is going to be coming out. You know, if somebody finds out what happened, you know, give us a call, let us know. we'd be interested in hearing the story. But in the meanwhile, like I said, the important thing is that the book's coming out and that people are going to be able to enjoy it, and we are going to be able to wrap that up.
Well, and August is, it's coming out in August, which is the 25th anniversary of Dragons of Autumn Twilight, which
that's right.
I think they're going to be celebrating at Gen Con. So,
Margaret and I both were young teenagers when that was written, as I remember.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I think you guys were 13 and 14, if I remember.
13
correctly.
And 14 at the time, yeah. It was a prodigy sort of a thing. And, yeah, but it is. We're hoping that there'll be a celebration. I think it would be a deserving thing to do, is to celebrate Dragonettes.
We'll have a celebration, Tracy, if nobody else does.
That's true. You and I will have a big party. It'll be awesome.
We will. Yeah, we'll bake a cake.
Right.
We'll make sure to record it, and we'll play it on the show.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on that. 25 years is amazing. And I definitely had to follow up on that, because, Tracy, I've gotten more emails about that than I think any other topic that's ever been covered on the show. I mean, I still get emails about it from listeners who are just listening to the older shows as they discover the new shows, and they go back and listen to all the old ones. So I'm just glad that it's all worked out and the fans will get their book. Are you going to write any more Dragonlance books, or for now is this it?
We've got so many things that are going on right now. A 6-book series with Tor, and I'm writing in addition to that, I'm writing a 3-book series with Daw right now. We've also got we're also exploring some other things as well. So we're pretty busy folks.
I did a Wonder Woman comic book with my daughter, Liz, a Wonder Woman graphic novel. And we had so much fun that we definitely want to do another, maybe not Wonder Woman, but somebody else.
Margaret, you've got to tell us, did they let you wear the cape? That's
Yeah, they let Liz. She dressed up as Wonder Woman for Halloween, so they let Liz wear the cape.
And I missed that.
Yes, you did.
No, I've seen The Incredibles. You're not supposed to wear the cape. It'll just get you in trouble, remember?
That's right. Yeah. The cape will just get you in trouble.
Well, so very cool. There's plenty on the plate then, so we won't worry about that right now. Last time we spoke, Tracy, you also mentioned that next time we talked, you wanted to discuss the importance of the reader and how the story really takes place in the reader's mind more than it does on the writer's page. Would you two like to elaborate on that now and what the reader has meant to you?
Well, if I can take just a moment and hopefully be hopefully convey everything that I feel about that. Margaret and I have long appreciated our readers, and especially because the reader is our partner in the creation of these wonderful places. The reader is an active participant in the creative process. When we look and we consider language itself, the written word itself, it's just a set of linear symbols. As a communications medium, it's really very low bandwidth, as we like to say these days. You can transmit an entire book very easily as an attachment on an email. But all of these symbols that are in a line on the page are taken by the reader, and the reader, as they interpret those symbols that are on that page, it is the reader that breathes life into the text. That is where the experience takes place. Until the reader reads the written word, it just lies on the page and is dead. When the reader reads, it takes those symbols on the page and translates those into meaning, into sights and sounds and smells and emotions and feelings and meaning that are not necessarily in the words themselves, but are an important part of the creation of the experience that's there. So the actual experience of the text, the actual reality that takes place when the text is created in the reader's mind, not by the author. So the reader is actually the one where the experience takes place. My wife likes to say that reading is one of those places where the actual performance takes place, where the author is not present.
Right, right.
Yeah. Because the performance takes place within the reader's mind. That's where the meaning takes place. It's the reader that translates the words into not only experience, but very often into action as well. That's why the written word is so powerful, far more powerful, I think, in affecting people than other media and media that has simultaneity like film or television. We think of those as being very impactful, and they are impactful. They're very easy, and they're very good at giving us meaning. But the written word brings us to meaning, and it's a very different thing.
Just think of all the times you've heard people say that the movie was good, but it wasn't as good as the book. Mm-hmm. And that is because the movie of the book has been cast and played in their minds.
And that's what's always interesting about reading books that are based on film property, is some of that creative process is taken away from you. And I don't mean to speak negatively about that, because it was Star Trek novels that got me reading. If not for Star Trek novels, I didn't come from a reading family. So I don't know if I ever would have picked up books on my own if not for Star Trek. But when I started reading other things outside of Star Trek is when I first started to experience the process that you're talking about, Tracy.
Well, yeah, the reader is such an active participant there. I have often said that reading the written word is the most interactive media that we have, because it isn't leading us around by the nose. It opens doors to meaning in people. You can have an epiphany in the midst of reading a book that a very formulaic or structured film is not going to lead you to.
Yeah.
Our whole new media in terms of news, modern news, is to provide you with meaning rather than help you come to a conclusion. It's all very nicely packaged for you. Meaning is placed in front of you and fed to you rather than given to you as something to think through. Again, that's the power of the written word, and why it is so important that we as a people become a reading people, I think, as opposed to just a passively watching people. We need to be more engaged, and I think reading is a more engaging activity for the mind.
Excellent. Margaret and Tracy, I have just one last question from you, and it comes from Twitter. I posted on there that I was interviewing you today and said, hey, does anyone have a question? And Jay Rambaz wanted to know, and Margaret, we'll start with you on this one. How have you maintained such a high level of productivity for so many years? You know, what drives you?
I love what I do. Writing was my major in college, and every morning I get up and I sit down and I write. And I can't think of anything else I'd rather be doing, except maybe going to flyball races with my dogs, but you can't do that all the time and you can't make a living at that. So I write.
I'm sure someone could figure out a way to make a living.
Make a way to do that. Yeah, Mark will be there.
Yeah, exactly. And how about you, Tracy?
You know, it's interesting. Again, Margaret and I are so very different. For me, I suppose fear can lead me to do my writing. I look at my wife and my children and my mortgage, and I think, oh man, I better write something. and truth be told, writing for me personally is very hard work. There are times when I sit down and I put my hands on the keyboard and then I just beat my head bloody against the screen that's in front of me. And there are days when writing feels like a trip to the dentist. But that being said, once I get into the flow of the words, once I get into the place where story exists, There's no place like it. It's far removed from my office and my desk. It's far removed from family and mortgage and the world. And being there and being able to share that with people is an extraordinary thing. While I find the process of writing often to be a very painful thing, nevertheless, it is a compulsion that I have now, and I would not trade it for anything else in the world. This ability to share story with people, and hopefully that somewhere out there there's going to be that young man, that young woman who picks up this book in a dire time, and it has something in there in its words that leads them to a better place. That inspires them to do something in their own lives. Margaret and I have seen this time and again as we have met with people and all down through our writing career. And each time we are supremely grateful to these wonderful readers who take our words and translate them into incredible action in their lives. That's something that they have done and something that we feel very privileged to have participated in some small way. So while it's difficult, perhaps it's in many ways those readers out there that I can't see that bring me back to this keyboard every day and that keep the words coming.
Man, after speaking with you guys tonight, I'm ready to go write another 800 words and
excellent.
See, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. You know, one quick story for you, anecdotally, just to give an example of what you're speaking to. A friend of mine I went to high school with went on a missions trip with another guy that we went to high school with. And these two, they weren't friends in high school. They didn't like each other very much. But they were talking and giving each other a chance, and my friend realized that this other guy was reading a Dragonlance novel. And my friend's a huge R.A. Salvatore fan, and he hadn't read Dragonlance yet, but he was certainly very much into that genre. And that book helped sort of bring them together in this experience. They had something in common. And I'm not saying they're best friends now or anything. I honestly don't know the state of their relationship, but I do know that they formed a respect for each other during that time, and your book played a part in that. So I think that's a powerful thing that that really speaks to what you're talking about, Tracy.
Well, thank you. Yes, I mean, Margaret and I are going to be seeing Bob Salvatore at the end of next month. So, you know, we'll pass that on that it was our book that brought that.
Yeah, not Bob's. No,
Bob,
not
Bob. Probably was very divisive in terms of their relationship. But ours.
Yeah, everybody in Boston, we're coming to Boston the end of February to the Boston Public Library.
That's right.
Wow. Very
to
cool.
The Boston Public Library.
Are you going to the one that Bob's on the board for, or just
we don't
one?
Know. We just know. We just go where they tell us.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll let me show my movie there, Margaret.
Oh, I don't know. Did you have to get releases?
Well, I have to get permission from, like, I don't know, NASA or
the
somebody.
The Soviet government?
Soviet government, I think, from the Soviet Union. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, say hello to Bob for me when you see him. I haven't talked to him in a while, but he's been on the show several times. And so say hello
to
him.
He's one of our favorite people. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's been wonderful having both of you on the show today. Is there anything else you wanted to mention that I didn't ask?
Tracy, you want to tell them about your movie really quickly?
Is this the animated film?
Oh, No. This is my top secret film. Did I tell you about this?
I don't know about the top secret film, no.
Okay, I'll tell you about the top secret film. I can tell you about the top secret film. I just can't show it to you. I'd have to tell you. Richard Garriott, who's a pioneer in computer game design, he wrote the Ultima series and more recently Tabula Rasa. He worked on that. A couple of months ago, flew to the International Space Station aboard a Soyuz spacecraft and spent 10 days on the International Space Station. Well, he was doing a number of wonderful and important scientific experiments while he was there, but he also wanted to do something different while he was there. And so he contacted me, and I wrote for him and created software so that he could film a movie while on the space station. And so I wrote this movie and did the software for him and sent him up to the space station. He filmed this film on the space station in orbit.
Wow.
Came back to Earth and then transmitted the footage back to me over the internet from Star City, Russia. I then edited the film together and am now, I suppose, officially the writer and editor of the first science fiction movie ever actually made in space.
That is awesome.
So it's an epic motion picture, 8.5 minutes in length, and but it was an awful lot of fun. It's got a couple of astronauts in it and the cosmonaut who were happily shanghaied into taking parts in the film.
They're really a captive on.
Well, where could they go? Seriously, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
There was a little tussle over dressing rooms, but we won't go into that. So we have the first science fiction movie made in space, although very few people have actually seen it, because it was made in secret and getting permissions to actually show it to any number of people would be a tremendously difficult task.
Well, yeah. See if you could do that and bring it to Boston. That would be awesome.
I'll see if I can get permission. If I can do it as a private showing, I think maybe I can get away with it. I'll ask Richard if we can do that. But it'd be kind of fun to show that epic film in front of people.
Yeah. So, is this something that will ever be released, or do you not have the rights to it?
Well, Richard owns the rights to the film, of course, because let's face it, he paid the big bucks to go and film it. And and it is his film. And the question, of course, eventually is going to be whether the astronauts and the cosmonaut who are involved in it will give permission to have it shown. Richard's very hopeful about doing it. And to be truthful, the astronauts and the cosmonaut, everybody that he was on the flight with were really fabulous people. And it's an interesting thing, actually, my experience from all of this that I've taken away from all of this is that the Russian cosmonauts, American astronauts, all of them were wonderful people, got along beautifully together, developed tremendous friendships. It was governments that got in the way. And I think that that's a sad state of affairs when people can get along so well. If government's in the way, it really should get out of the way and let the rest of us get on with the business of making a better world.
Yeah. Amen.
So there's my comment for the evening. But who knows? We may be able to show this film yet, Margaret, and I'd love to show it to you. I'll show it to you and Bobby, if nothing else.
That's all right. That's great.
Very cool. And I'm going to call you him Bobby the next time I see him.
Yeah, call him Bobby. I'll show it to you, Margaret, Bobby, and about 400 of our most intimate friends.
Right, yeah.
The book is Bones of the Dragon, out in bookstores now. Check it out and visit the show notes for all the links you will need to learn more about the book and the authors. Tracy, Margaret, thank you very, very much for being here.
Our pleasure.
Oh, thank you. We really appreciate it. This has been fun.
Century Japan is a dangerous place, even in a rare time of peace. Bloodthirsty demons, shape-changing animals, and capricious spirits are as real as the sword in Kenichi's hand, and the wise sarcastic dog at his side. When Kenichi, a young masterless samurai, a ronin, saves a noble girl from a bandit ambush, he and his dog become enmeshed in the intrigues of samurai lords, vengeful constables, Mongol spies, and a shadowy underworld crime boss known as Green Tiger. Heart of the Ronin by Travis Hearman is an action-packed historical fantasy set against the backdrop of ancient intrigue and impending war. check out the free audio fiction podcast at travishearman.com or subscribe on iTunes.
Do it, or my ninja will find you.
Thank you again to Margaret and Tracy for being on the show. As you can tell, I had a lot of fun talking with them. They're really, really cool people.
They're great.
And their new book, Bones of the Dragon, is in bookstores right now, so go check it out.
I just want to say one thing about that. I will always love them. They could do no wrong to me for me, because...
Why don't you marry them then?
Yeah, whatever. Well, I would have... I was a polygamist. Okay. All right. One man's enough, okay? I'm just saying. Anyways. Yeah, you know, I really credit them for being, you know, some of the first authors that really got me into science fiction. I remember reading Dragonlance, the first one, the summer of, like, I think sixth grade. And I picked up the first book because my local science fiction bookstore recommended it to me. And I just tore through that series. I went down, used my whole, you know, allowance, babysitting money, you name it, to buy every single Dragonlance title I could get my hands on. And they really helped create the voracious science fiction and fantasy reader that I am today. So I will always be thankful to them for that. And I recommend it when I'm in the store. I recommend it a lot for people that age group. And 9 times out of 10, you know, they're back in the store the following week, gathering up all the books from the shelf and bringing up to the counter and buying them all.
So. And which is why they still sell so well. You know, one of the reasons they still sell so well. But as people grow up, you know, they read them when they're teenagers, and they pass them on.
Yeah, you know,
they
absolutely
keep it alive. And that's a huge thing that authors just can't do that on their own.
Yeah.
You know, readers do that, which speaks to what Tracy was talking about, the importance of the reader and the story. You know, the reader creates the story, and how important the reader is in that.
The story lives within the reader's own mind.
Yeah, yeah. So, and for me, and I've talked about this, so Star Trek books, and, you know, Star Trek is the same thing. The parents who grew up with it in the 60s kept it alive for their children, who then watched The Next Generation.
Exactly.
And my dad kept that alive for me, so I'm watching, you know, Deep Space Nine and Voyager, and I even watched everything of Enterprise, which had some good shows.
That's
some good
fandom
episodes
right there.
Yeah, yeah. But let's get on to some email, shall we?
That sounds good. And we got an email from Emilio, who says, I don't often write to podcasts I listen to, figuring the hosts already have lots of friends and listeners they converse with. Speak for yourself, Sean.
Oh, sorry.
I have friends, okay?
I forget that I'm alone in this little bubble.
listeners they converse with, and they are not in need of yet another person to suck up more of their time. However, I do want to say you guys... Inclusive, non-gender specific, colloquial term describing two or more people, not necessarily the male persuasion. Thank you, Emilio. I am from California, so I get that. I get that. you guys have kept me company for many of the hours I drive. Unfortunately, I'm all cut up now and, or caught up now, as the case may be, and forced to patiently wait for additional content. No need to write back, as that might lead to friendship, which could curtail my ability to freely criticize future shows in case you guys start to suck. But I did want to say, keep up the good work, and I'll continue to be a loyal listener. And I have one comment about that. We'll try our hardest not to suck about that, Emilio.
It's always the top of the list. Don't suck in this show.
To do today.
Actually,
don't suck.
I wrote Emilio back in... He wrote me back and he's like, darn you, I said don't write me back.
Yeah. Hey, Emilio, guess what? You're my friend now.
That's
whether
right.
You like it or not, sucka.
No matter how
that.
Bad she sucks, you can't criticize her.
Or, well, we'll just leave that right
yes,
there.
Yes, that's
it is.
A good one. So thank you, Emilio. That was I got a kick out of that email, so I had to make sure we read the whole thing in here.
Pretty darn funny.
Speaking of emails and voicemails, in the last episode of season 2, episode 71 with Bear McCrary, we asked you guys and gals, non-gender.
Actually was gender specific.
Yeah, I was. I got both in, though. Sorry. Whenever you're writing an essay, he/she, right? Or one, whatever. Anyway.
If you want to be snooty.
Yeah. We asked you folks to write in and let us know who your favorite guest of 2008 was. And whoa, we got no responses. So, I know it's a busy time of year with Christmas and New Year and all that. So we'll try it one more time. We'll keep this alive until the next episode.
And then we're going to do call in to tell us why you don't call in.
And that'd be because they're too busy to call in for the lonely little podcaster and this very busy co-host who has lots of friends and social interaction. But
jealous much?
But yeah, call in and let us know who your favorite guest was of 2008. And if you need a reminder, you can just look in iTunes, you know, they're all listed there. Go to the website, whatever. But we would be interested. You can send an email too if you don't have time to call the voicemail line, which is 206-350-5029. So that's that.
We've added a number of articles to the website since the last episode. So please give us a visit for news, reviews, and a featured article compiles all of Hollywood-themed interviews we've done, including the stars of Stargate SG-1, Atlantis, the makers of Ray Bradbury's Chrysalis, and more.
Yeah, that was a fun article to put together because I realized that they're sort of buried in the feed. And we're a show about literature, so then, you know, we only have, I think there's 6 episodes that we've done that aren't about literature.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. So I thought, let's highlight these so people can find them easily if they want to.
Especially all those Stargate fans who are like, what?
Yeah.
How did I miss this?
Yeah. Those are cool. Actually, no, the Stargate SG-1 interview, though, that's in the text interview section. If you have to click on the interview tab, I didn't actually get audio for that. Oh. Sorry. I lied. Anyway, now that I'm lying, let's go ahead and wrap this one up. Please send us your feedback and your questions. We'd love to hear from you guys and get you in the show. And until next time,
keep reading.
Thank you for listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Please visit our website at adventuresinscifipublishing.com for online interviews, book reviews, news stories, coverage of live events, videos, and much more. You can send us an email at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com and give us a call at 206-350-5029. Music by Cargo Cult from their track Dirt, available at magnatune.com. You've been listening to a Singularity Audio production. To learn more, please visit www.singularityaudio.com.